welcome back to Voice of the Cape Drive Time, 91.3. And, of course, 072-238-0712 is our WhatsApp line. In studio, I have a very special guest. I was given her resume and a CV, but I'm not going to read it because we actually need to have a program. This is somebody who has achieved a tremendous amount in her life. She is Dr. Turbina Yeselhark. Hopefully I'm pronouncing her names correctly.
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of. Okay, I always get that, especially from people who come from your part of the world, but we'll try. Our guest, she holds a Doctor of Philosophy from Durham University in the United Kingdom. Her thesis was on theodicy and the problem of evil in Islam. She's the author of A Muslim Response to Evil, Said Nursi on the Theodicy. Said Nursi, a well-known Turkish scholar. Dr. Turbanur has done so many things, but she's also got an Islamic Studies and Christian Relations MA from Hartford Seminary in the USA. She's committed to interfaith dialogue, and she is in South Africa as a guest of the Islamic Medical Association. Now, the IMA is having, can you believe it, its 39th annual conference at the Lord Charles Hotel in Somerset West from the 15th to the 16th of June. Dr. Turbanur is the special guest of speaker of the conference, and she's also talking tomorrow at the Claremont Main Road Mosque. She'll be giving the pre-khutbah talk tomorrow. But Dr. Turbanur Yeselhark, hopefully I haven't killed your name.
No.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you've certainly had a very active life in terms of your age, doctors of philosophy all over the place, lots of studying, and your interest is being put down as interfaith dialogue. What motivated you? What got you interested in the idea of interfaith dialogue? Everybody talks about it today, but probably doesn't understand what it really means.
Yes, that's a very good question, actually. And the reason why I got actually into interfaith dialogue was because I am of Turkish descent originally. However, I was born and raised up in Germany. So, born and being raised in Germany and being the second generation of the Turkish community in Germany, I could see that the second generation of Turkish people were in an identity crisis, really. So it was kind of like a lost generation, really, not knowing where they belong to, because neither did they feel really belonging to the Turkish descent, nor were they accepted really by the German community either. So it was kind of like a lost generation. And me, myself, also being the second generation, I realized that something needed to be done. So we founded at that time, together with some other friends, we founded the Christian Muslim Association in Stuttgart, where I was based. And for many years, we have been involved through that in interfaith dialogue, especially and particularly with the Christian community.
How has it been going in Germany? Because often we get snatches of what's occurring in countries like Germany in terms of Muslim-Christian relations. I wouldn't have to tell you that Europe is going through some very interesting times, right-wing governments coming in. So how is the interfaith landscape in Germany, for example? Because in South Africa, we just simply don't know.
When I came, it's the first time that I'm coming actually to South Africa, and being in South Africa, I've realized that you have got lots of interfaith marriages. So, dialogue here is sort of different from the dialogue that you would have in Germany, because here it's kind of natural. It's in the family. It's you've got your mother as a Christian, your father as a Muslim, grandfathers and grandmothers, and so on and so forth. So it's basically, penetrated in the family, basically, and it's something natural in a way. Whereas in Germany, and I think in also other countries in Europe, you have to literally work towards interfaith dialogue to approach the other religion, to approach the other people, and and try to make friendships on a grassroots level. And that's also what I'm saying always. I don't believe that dialogue is possible on an intellectual, academic level. You know, inviting people from the Christian faith, from the Muslim faith, and asking them to give certain intellectual talks about their own religion,
and then calling it
interreligious dialogue. That's not, you know, that's not what dialogue is all about. Dialogue is about making friendships on the grassroots levels, going to each other's houses, having tea with each other, being friends, seeing, you know, that the concerns of a Muslim mother with her children and her day-to-day life is not different from a Christian mother and her concerns about her children and her life, basically.
It's interesting you've used the mother example, because what I've witnessed is that women around the world seem to be able to network a lot better than men. And it's amazing, and particularly if they have children, there seems to be a common bond. And it's interesting you say that that interfaith dialogue should actually take place at that level. It's simple, isn't it? I mean, it's sometimes it's just a cup of tea, not talking about your faith, but talking about real things, in a sense.
Day-to-day things, yeah. Day-to-day concerns that, you know, every human being really shares with each other.
Mm. But how do you convince somebody in Germany to come to, let's say you're having a so-called interfaith event, but obviously you aren't going to be talking about the seerah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, getting complicated about it, and was this person crucified or not, all the cliches. So how do you manage to attract people to what you would classify in Germany, for example, as an interfaith event? I'm curious.
Well, what we did when we first came up, founded actually the association, was literally knocking on people's doors and asking whether they would be interested in coming and joining. Also, you know, mouth-to-mouth advertisement, in a sense, was also very much in the forefront. But at the end of the day, sometimes it happens that, you know, the people that you can reach are, you know, at the end of the day, it's the people that are already interested in knowing the other faith, in knowing their neighbors, in wanting to, you know, get introduced to the people that they're living with within the community. Those who are, you know, neglecting and who are not interested or even against, in a sense, won't really come anyway. Or if they come, they will come to, you know, ask, you know, troubling questions, or, you know, make troubling comments, really.
It's interesting, in the European context, in Holland, for example, two of the biggest Islamophobes ended up becoming Muslims themselves. That's quite ironic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, this is always the point. I mean, people are afraid of the unknown. They're afraid of what they don't know. But once they open up, and once they are curious, and they want to learn more, and they start, you know, communicating with people of the other faith, it opens up to them that it's not really very different from, you know, their own lives and their own day-to-day concerns. And once you know something, you get acquainted to it, and then you're not afraid anymore.
Right. Is Islamophobia a real threat in Europe? We hear media reports, and I'm in the media often. Media tends to telescope things, and one event seems to be like the whole country is burning when it isn't. Is Islamophobia a problem in a country like Germany, for example?
Well, I think it is, to be honest. At least it should be treated as such.
Right.
Because, as you said, you know, the media and as well as social media, you know, nowadays is bursting it. You know, I don't think it is as big as it is shown in the media, but people, they get informed nowadays from the media. They get all their information from the media. And especially within social media, you've got people don't want to sit down and read a 200-page book anymore. They just want to, you know, they just read little snippets from here and there, and they watch this video and that video, and then they think that they know about a certain topic or about, you know, and they think they're informed. I think it is something that needs to be taken serious and being discussed about.
And I mean, the whole Islamophobia thing, does it extend beyond the borders of Germany? Because in Germany we've seen a lot of questions about Islam and relations in Islam in Germany, particularly after the Syrian crisis, when Germany was one of the only few only countries in Europe to actually take in refugees, and that seemed to create a scenario.
Well, I congratulate actually Germany, and I've done that as well. You know, during the period when they have taken on the Syrian refugees, you know, it was a very good thing of Germany to do. And I was at the same time surprised as well, to be honest.
Yes, it was surprising, but it was refreshing
to see
at least one European country having a heart. It's as simple as that.
Definitely.
It was disappointing from our distance seeing the cruel, absolutely inhuman responses of some of the countries just shutting off their borders to people who had nowhere to go.
Yes, that is correct. And especially also in the Middle East, many countries have shut their borders and they haven't, you know, taken their brothers and sisters into the country, which was very disturbing, you know. And then if you see a European country opening up the borders and taking so many refugees in, is, as you said, is very refreshing and very positive, you know.
When we take a look at your interest in interfaith dialogue, something that fascinates me, this is an English translation of stuff you've written, but the word evil comes up twice. Is this deliberate? The one says theodicy and the problem of evil in Islam, and the other says a Muslim response to evil, Said Nursi on theodicy. Said Nursi, incidentally, is quite well known in South Africa, his books. I've even got some of his books. But tell us something about, is the word evil, is this deliberate, or is it a bad translation of Turkish and German?
Evil, well... actually, from a Muslim point of view, we don't really use the term evil. We use the term shar.
Exactly,
right?
Yes.
And the Quranic definition of shar differs from the mainstream understanding of evil that you will see and read in literature. Because in literature, there's always made a distinction between moral evil and natural evil. Natural evil referring to disasters, calamities, you know, natural disasters such as tsunamis and earthquakes and so on and so forth, and flooding and so on and so forth. However, in the Quranic context, you don't have natural shar. There is no such thing as natural shar. It's just categorized as calamities. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas shar, the Quranic definition of shar relates rather to certain attributes that are disliked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like, for example, disbelief, kufr, or shirk, you know, associating other partners with God, or slander, or accumulating wealth. Talking behind the back of somebody else. And, you know, so these attributes are being defined in the Quran as shar. So it's completely different, really, understanding from the general, you know, thought that what you would think that evil is. Because in the context, death is being considered as evil, for example. If you talk to people, it's even considered by some scholars as the worst of evils.
Whereas in the Islamic perspective, I've been taught that evil is actually a creation. It's part of the creation of Allah, as you have dark and you have light.
Exactly.
If you have life, life doesn't mean anything unless there's death.
Exactly.
How philosophical I am this afternoon. Yeah. Let's also move on in the sense that you are now visiting a country like South Africa. You say it's your first visit, so I don't know how long you've been here. I always like to ask people, what have your impressions been so far, positive and negative? You can be negative if you want to. We're quite used to it. But, I mean, you know, what are your impressions, especially in the context of you being the guest speaker at the 39th, can you believe it, 39 years IMA, and this is an organization, Islamic Medical Association, who have done amazing work over the last 39 years. I can vouch for what they've done, believe you me. And in the context of you being their guest speaker and the theme of the conference, looking at revival of Islamic values in professional practice.
Well, I'm truly humbled and also honored to have been invited by the IMS people to attend this convention. And I'm really also very happy to have known them, because they're such nice hosts at the same time.
So your host is sitting here. You have to be nice, eh? Right.
So my impression of Cape Town is a very positive one, actually, because the smiling faces started right at the borders when we entered.
Right.
Uh-huh. So which you don't see really very often when you enter a country. You know, you rather see, you know, not smiling faces.
Yeah, no, that can be tough sometimes, indeed. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So I was kind of surprised and positively surprised when I saw the officer smiling at us and even making little jokes, you know.
All right.
Uh-huh. So that was the very first impression that I got. And then when we entered, you know, you see people greeting you on the streets, and everybody is easygoing and smiling and has a positive attitude. And I believe that I'm sure that there is lots of problems going on in Cape Town as well. But despite those problems, seeing people still being able to smile and being able to have that positive attitude is very refreshing. What I was concerned a little bit about, and that was because we've seen it today, was the huge distance between rich and poor.
That's actually hitting the nail on the head. I mean, this is an enduring problem that we've had since the days of apartheid. We're going to quickly break for the news, but our special guest is Dr. Tubunar Yeselhark. She's going to be a guest speaker at the Islamic Medical Association 39th Annual Conference, Lord Charles Somerset West. A quick break for headlines, and we're going to be back right after this. Voice of the Cape 91.3, and our special guest in studio, Dr. Tubunar Yeselhark, an Islamic scholar described as that. She has a doctor of philosophy, and she has also studied Christian-Muslim relations, Islamic studies at Hartford Seminary in the USA. She is familiar with Turkish, German, English, and probably some other languages as well, which we haven't mentioned. But she is the guest of the Islamic Medical Association, their 39th conference, taking place in Cape Town this year at the Lord Charles Hotel from the 15th to the 16th of June. And tomorrow, don't forget it, she gives the pre-Khutbah talk at Claremont Main Road Masjid, and that is tomorrow for Jumu'ah. But Dr. Tubunar, before we had the break, you were talking about that you had observed the great disparities, the differences between rich and poor in Cape Town, and you're totally right in your observations. And of course, some of the challenges that we face in South Africa are that, and of course some of the medical challenges as well is also between the rich and the poor, and our hospital systems trying to cope with all of this. All right, I'm going to ask you a question after having made an observation. But generally speaking, you mentioned that people have conversations. I mean, in Cape Town, if we get lonely, we talk to lampposts. So we like talking. But looking at again at the IMA conference in terms of an ethos, an Islamic ethos in the workplace. Any general statements you can make with regards to that without giving away what you're going to be saying over the weekend? How's that for a challenge?
Well, yeah. I have been invited as a keynote speaker, but I will be presenting two papers at the convention.
Right.
And the first one that I'm going to talk about is around my studies, actually, around my area of interest, which is going to be about the existence / non-existence of Shar.
Yes.
So I'm not going to talk about the theodicy aspect. I'm not going to talk about, you know, why does God allow evil in this world to happen. I'm going to rather concentrate on the ontological aspect, which means on the wujudi aspect, existential aspect of Shar. So we're going to discuss about whether it exists or it doesn't exist, and if it doesn't exist, so why can we then still feel or see you know, evil happening around us. So this is going to be the keynote talk. And then at the panel, the second paper will be on a Muslim approach on calamities and illnesses, which is going to be a rather pastoral talk, you know, from a pastoral theology perspective.
Indeed, I mean, calamities and difficulties. I mean, the IMA over the years has contributed quite profoundly to all our humanitarian organizations. In fact, one of our biggest NGOs in the community, Gift of the Givers, Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, was a member of the IMA, and it was via the IMA that he actually started on what has been a long and illustrious career. And if you sort of go around the corridors of the IMA and the history, you'll find it's been very active in terms of, in fact, addressing human calamity. But do you think it's important that we do have to have a philosophical understanding of calamity sometimes? Because if we don't, we're not going to be able to accept it or understand it.
I think it is vital. I think it is very important because it the whole idea of, first of all, it's very existential. It is in our lives, isn't it? Mm. And people always try to find answers to those questions. Why is this happening to me? Mm-hmm. Have I done something wrong? What am I going to do with the situation that I'm in? It is connected to not only physical stress and physical non-well-being, but also it is very much connected with mental and spiritual, illnesses. Therefore, I think it is important that the metaphysical aspect of it, if you want to say so, the spiritual, the religious aspect of it, should also be addressed.
Now, I mean, it's an interesting question that you're raising there. I'm not a medical practitioner. Don't come to me for medicine. I'll probably kill you. But I'm sure you'd agree that a lot of people have of modern medicine is it seems to miss out sometimes on metaphysics, that a lot of medical practitioners come along and they're only looking at symptoms and they don't look at causes. I know I'm oversimplifying a massive argument, but I'm sure you'd agree that principally it's something that does have to be looked at.
Oh, definitely, because human beings are not made up only of bones and body. Mm-hmm. They have thoughts. They have kalb, what the
heart.
Scholars say, but not the heart in a sense of the bodily heart, the heart that you can touch,
the spiritual heart,
the spiritual heart aspect, yeah. Right? And also a lot of feelings that mostly we don't really understand where they come from, and we have also a lot of feelings that are in our innate nature that we have never experienced, that we don't even know they exist unless we are confronted with certain events in our lives. Through those events, they come to surface. And once they come to surface and we get introduced to them, we are in a state of shock because we don't know what to do with them. We don't know what to do with those feelings. And we sometimes neglect them, and sometimes we don't want to feel them. So what do we do in those situations? Mm-hmm. And I think it's not for a medical doctor, really, to answer those
questions. There's a medical doctor in the room here, so yeah.
So therefore, I'm always promoting, in a sense, also the fact that our imams, for example, when they go through their education, that they need to be also equipped with the psychological education, mm-hmm. In order to be able to consult their communities. And even I think medical doctors should be in a certain, up to a certain extent, also have the religious sort of, equipment in order to be able to not maybe religiously guide directly the patients, but at least to be able to understand that a human being is not consisting only of body and bones and veins and, and organs.
Yeah, no. I suppose at the end of the day, it's a question of values.
It is.
I mean, in medicine, I've heard people talking about bedside manner, but that's a sort of a very broad term, which I think embraces a lot of the things that we're discussing already, that if you approach a human being as a human being, you get the response of a human being, and that makes the healing process that much easier.
Yes, yes. And also, of course, we shouldn't underestimate the idea, for example, the idea of or the belief in a life after death for a person who is, terminally ill or who is going through serious illness, mm-hmm. It is vital for that person to have that sort of belief. And in those circumstances, it is that's where spirituality comes to play. That's where religious values come into play.
Absolutely, because it's interesting. I can remember I was at a hospital many years ago, and when my parents had passed on, and a doctor came to me, and he had a long story. I said, "Don't worry." I said, "It's in God's hands." And he looked. And he said, "Are you Muslim?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Phew, thank God." That was his response, because he said, "This is a non-Muslim doctor." He said, "You know," he said, "what I like about you people," his exact words. He said, "You people understand what's going on." And he said, "I'm also a believer, and I think that there is like another life. We have to look at it in the sense that," he said, "that death, as he pointed out earlier, is part of creation as much as life is."
Definitely.
Just as an anecdotal sort of incidence,
yes,
in terms of, yeah.
Definitely. And I just want to stress here as well the importance of the pastoral theology aspect that needs to be established, as a discipline within the universities, especially the Muslim universities, Islamic universities, mm-hmm. who are training chaplains, who are training Muslim chaplains and imams, that they have this equipment of being able to provide proper pastoral care to the communities, to those Muslim people who are coming to the imams for guidance, being in depression and having mental problems, so it's very important, and it's lacking at the moment. We don't have that really, and it's very important. So that's why, from my studies point of view, the Turkish scholar Said Nursi, for example, in his works, especially in his treatise on the sick and ill, he's very much pointing out the pastoral aspect of illnesses in a lengthy treatise that he has in his works. And it's very worthwhile looking into that as well.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Dr. Turban Yasalhark, we have to leave it there. She's a special guest of the Islamic Medical Association of South Africa, the annual 39th conference taking place at the Lord Charles Somerset Hospital, 15th to the 16th of June. If you're a doctor in the community, you can still attend, I'm sure. They'll make space for you, don't worry. And of course, on tomorrow, Friday, Dr. Turban Yasalhark will be giving the pre-khutbah talk at the Claremont Main Road Masjid. Shukran so much. Thanks for coming into the studio and talking to us. And I know that everybody at the IMA conference is going to hang on to every word.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure.